Thanks very much for that introduction, and thanks very much for having me here today. So what I'd like to do today is talk a bit about the bank's outlook for the economy. We publish this outlook in the Statement of Monetary Policy that we put out every quarter. We published this one a couple of weeks ago. So I hope this is of some use to you in thinking about the outlook for your business. So this set of forecasts was little change from the previous set of forecasts we released 3 months earlier. And that's because the economy, both here and elsewhere around the world, has generally been evolving in line with our expectations. So the forecast that we publish can be best characterised as the modal forecast for the economy. So if you can think back to your probability days, which you've probably forgotten, modal means most likely, basically. So we publish the modal forecast for the economy, the path for the economy we think is most likely to occur. But there are a number of risks to that outlook, and the statement talks about some of these uncertainties too, and I'll spend some time drawing out some of the issues around some of those uncertainties. So when you read our forecasts, if you read our forecasts, I think it's useful to avoid false precision. So an important question to ask is, are the revisions that we make to our outlook consequential for the monetary policy decision? Do those changes that we make affect your own decisions about your household or your business? So a tenth of a percentage point here or there on the outlook for growth or inflation, not likely to make much of a difference to any of those decisions. So I'd like you to keep that in mind when we run through the forecasts. So here are the forecasts we published just a few weeks back. As I said, they're little change from the ones we published in February. So this table shows you our forecast over the next few years for growth, unemployment, and inflation. So as I said, the two and a bit year horizon we've got there is generally the time frame that's relevant for the monetary policy decision and the deliberations the board takes on that. So that forecast embodies a number of technical assumptions. So these include that the cash rate, the rate that we actually set as the Reserve Bank Board, evolves broadly in line with market expectations. So currently the market assumes that the cash rate is likely to remain unchanged for at least the next 12 months and then rise only very slowly and gradually beyond that. The forecast also assumes that the exchange rate and oil prices remain at their current levels. Historically, we've found that assuming those variables remain constant is at least as good as any other forecast, while recognising that they are likely to change. And I think that's important to think about in your own business decisions when you get, better be careful because I know Westpac's a sponsor here, but anyway, when you get advice on the exchange rate forecast from institutions like them, that often the best forecaster is just to assume that the exchange rate remains constant. May well be wrong, but it's probably better than any other forecast you're likely to be given. So in saying that, it's worth noting that the exchange rate has moved within a fairly narrow range over the past couple of years. So really, those variations we've had in the exchange rate over the past 2 years or so have probably not been a major factor in your decision-making as CFOs. In contrast, I'd expect that the 20% depreciation of the Australian dollar we had just prior to that did have a material impact on decision-making at any business with an export or import competing focus. So other developments in financial conditions beyond the cash rate and beyond the exchange rate can affect the forecast too. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about something which is going on right at the moment, and which may well be also having an impact on you as CFOs. And that's development in some money market rates, both here and in particular in the US. So in the statement, we document the rise. So what I've got here is LIBOR, US dollar LIBOR, and then BBSW, which as I'm sure you're probably aware is the major reference rate here in Australia. I'm actually, in about 3 hours' time, I'm giving a speech in Hong Kong from here. But on some issues around these reference rates, which if you do use them in your business, or you do have contracts which reference them, I would suggest you actually have a look at what I'm saying in a few hours' time, because there is some risk, particularly around LIBOR, that it may not exist in a few years' time, certainly in its current form, and that may be something which actually has an impact on your business. So, but as you can see there, over the last 2 months or so, since around beginning of February, there was a fairly sharp rise in LIBOR and in BBSW. So there are a number of explanations for the rise, including a very large increase in debt issuance by the US Treasury and the effect of various tax changes in the US on investment decisions by CFOs at some US companies with large cash pools. So as you may be aware, there's an incentive now for some of those large US companies, most obviously the tech companies, which have a lot of cash offshore in the financial sense, not necessarily in the geographic sense, to bring those that money back onshore. They used to. Another reason why you've seen a large rise in LIBOR. So this rise in LIBOR in the US has been reflected in rises in money market rates in a number of countries, including here in Australia. And that's because the Australian banks raised some of their short-term funding in the US market to fund their lending back here. So the rise in price in the US in LIBOR has led to a similar rise in the cost of short-term funding for the banks here, that is, BBSW has gone up. This increases the wholesale funding costs for the Australian banks, and it does also increase the cost for borrowers whose lending rates are priced off BBSW, which I suspect includes some of you. However, the effect to date has not been that large in terms of the overall impact on bank funding costs. That is, thus far, it has not been a consequential development from a forecasting point of view, from our point of view. It's also not clear how much of that rise in LIBOR and hence BBSW is due to structural changes in money markets and how much is temporary. And actually, as you can see, in the last 2 weeks, it's actually reversed about half of that increase. And so we'll continue to see how this unfolds in the period ahead, but as to whether how much of that rise remains there and how much continues to be reversed. So if you go back to the table I had a second ago, if I can do that, there we go. The outlook for the economy in 2018 and 2019, you can see there, is expected to be a little stronger than what occurred in 2017. GDP growth is expected to pick up from around 2.5% at the end of last year to be around 3.25% over the next couple of years. So what's driving that pickup in growth? One part of the answer is that the global conjuncture is constructive at the moment. We've been witnessing, or in the midst of, the most synchronized pickup in the global economy for quite some time. The US economy is doing well, Europe is doing better than it has been for the whole of the past decade, the Japanese economy has just recorded its longest period of quarterly growth in almost 3 decades. That was 8 quarters in a row, which is the most consecutive quarters of growth they've had in nearly 30 years. The global conjuncture has been reflected in a pickup in global industrial production and trade that is particularly beneficial to the East Asian region, which is highly leveraged into the global cycle. Now, China stands a little in contrast to those developments, though. Growth in China has moderated somewhat in part because since around the late last year, the authorities there are pursuing other policy objectives to address pollution and financial stability risks, or risk in their financial system in particular. But the easing in growth in China has been small, and it remains to be seen just how much tolerance the authorities there have to any significant slowing in growth. So one interesting point about the global conjuncture is that while the recovery is synchronized, to date we haven't seen it accelerate in any meaningful way. Historically, when we've had synchronized growth cycles, they've tended to be self-reinforcing, leading to an ongoing pickup in growth. But today, what we've got is growth in most economies around the world is good, and often a little bit above trend, but no economy is actually growing that much above trend. So if I show you, these are the forecast for the major advanced economies, so the US, the Euro area, and Japan. So the history and then the forecast over the next couple of years, you can actually see it stepping down over the next couple of years. So we have this pickup, hasn't kept on going. It's actually leveled off and even stepping down a bit. So why aren't we seeing a further pickup in global growth? I think part of that explanation is that the global financial crisis has left long-lasting scars. For a number of years, risks to the outlook have generally been characterized as being on the downside by both policymakers and by businesses, and that's still true today. If you ask people what the risks are, they'll give you a whole litany of downside risks and not too many upside ones. In contrast, if you can remember the last time we ever had a synchronized global upswing, say back in the mid-2000s or somewhere around there, the risks that people articulated generally had an upside slant to them. So even though we've seen a pickup in business sentiment right around the world, a sizable degree of caution and scepticism has accompanied that improvement in sentiment. Now maybe we're close to a tipping point where we see that tendency for pessimism switch over to optimism. That pessimism filter, though, has been reflected in the focus on restraint in business investment decisions in the past decade. It is also evident in the focus on cost cutting and contributes to the subdued outcome for wages and prices we have seen almost right around the world. The current more positive pace of global growth is also predicated on the stimulatory settings of monetary policy in place in most countries. That is, we have very stimulatory monetary policy right around the world. That's been necessary to deliver these growth outcomes. Those settings have countered the headwinds that have been present in the global economy over the past decade. Now, those headwinds have abated some, but it's not clear that they have yet switched to be tailwinds. One possible exception to that, though, is the US. So there's a large fiscal stimulus in train in the US this year and next, and that's been delivered in an economy that has already got very limited spare capacity. Historically, such as in the late 60s, early 70s, such episodes have generally led to stronger growth, but also higher inflation. So I'll come back to that in my discussion of some of the uncertainties around the outlook in a few minutes. This constructive global outlook provides a solid backdrop for domestic developments. It is underpinning growth in our exports, and exports have also been boosted by the additional capacity coming on stream in LNG. We expect that the additions to capacity in our main resource exports, iron ore, LNG and coal, will be largely complete by the end of the year. But that also means that we're very close to the end of the decline in mining investment, which has been going on for some time. So I've got here, we've split up investment into the mining sector or resource sector and the non-mining sector. And you can see here, since around about 2013, we've been having a decline in mining investments. So we're a very large peak in growth in mining investment through up until around about 2012. And then after that, as these projects have started to be completed, that investment's declined. And that's been a major drag on economic growth over the past several years. Now, the absence of that negative is actually a positive, particularly when one factors in the associated export growth that has resulted from that investment in the resource sector. The decline in resource investment has also had negative spillovers to the non-mining sector, particularly in the resource-intensive states of WA and Queensland. That now seems also to be largely past. Moreover, the increase in public infrastructure spending is creating positive spillovers. And importantly, the rise in business sentiment globally is also evident in Australia. And all of those factors are reflected in the pickup in investment in the non-mining sector, you can see in the top half of the graph there, we've seen over the past 4 years. So I turn to consumption, the household sector. We've actually had some more validation of our outlook with recent data revisions. So we had been concerned that our forecast may have been a little optimistic. So it so happens that the Bureau of Statistics found a bunch more consumption. Naturally, optimistic forecast turned out to be about right, which is always good, doesn't always happen. But now we're more confident in that forecast. So in statistical terms, the weight on the modal forecast we have for consumption has risen. But uncertainties remain around the outlook for consumption, and I'll discuss some of them shortly. It's also worth noting that domestic demand growth has outstripped growth in GDP, so the difference between those is mostly net exports, and it's running at around 3.25%. That gives us confidence in our forecast of GDP growth a little above trend over the next couple of years. That is, GDP growth is likely to have a 3 in front of it. And the surveys of business conditions, which I've got here by a split up across a few sectors. So they very much support the assessment that conditions in many parts of the economy, this is by asking people like you, are assessed to be well above average. And you can see there, it's not just this time around a story of one sector or another. It's positive in all sectors, including even in retail. So that pace of growth of a bit over 3%, should it transpire, will eat gradually into the spare capacity in the economy. Hence, we expect the unemployment rate to gradually decline from here. So I'll just show you our forecast of the unemployment rate. So the black line is our central forecast, modal forecast of the economy. Those error bands around, think of them as confidence intervals around the unemployment rate forecast based on history of errors in unemployment rate forecasts. So with 70% likelihood, it's somewhere between 4.5 and 6, which may sound like a pretty chunky range, but that just gives you some idea of the uncertainties around economic forecasting. But you can see there the central line is a continuation of the decline in the unemployment rate, gradual decline that we've had over the past few years. So I find the unemployment rate is generally the most useful statistics to assess the state of the labour market. In fact, if you ask me what's probably the most useful statistic to find out, to think about what's going on in the economy, the unemployment rate's got to be pretty close to the top of that list. Now, the last couple of, for the last, since around mid last year or so, the unemployment rate's actually gone sideways for a bit. And that's been in an environment where employment growth is measured to be particularly strong. So what's going on there is that labour supply has been measured to rise strongly alongside that very strong growth in employment. Part of the explanation for this is an increase in female participation that Kelly O'Dwyer talked about. And it's also the older workers remaining in the employment longer than they used to. That strong employment growth has reduced unused capacity, which is a positive development, but not in a way that has lowered the unemployment rate. That said, forward indicators in terms of vacancies and hiring intentions of businesses remain very positive. GDP growth we expect to pick up, so that gives me reasonable confidence that the unemployment rate will resume its gradual downward trend, which is what we've got there in that line. That gradual decline in spare capacity is expected to lead to a gradual pickup in wages growth. A critical question is, when will wages actually start to rise in a meaningful way? Recent data on wages provides some assurance that wages growth has troughed. So this is the wage price index, which sort of aggregates wage movements across the whole economy for someone staying in the same job. So not shifting from job to job, but staying in the same job. And you can see there that it looks like it's troughed and it's just edged up slightly. Also, when we talk to the firms, which may hopefully include a decent number of you in our business liaison program, majority of firms expect wages growth to remain broadly stable over the period ahead. That is, it gives us more confidence that we are at a trough. Moreover, over the past year, there has been an increase in the number of firms we talk to expecting higher wage growth outcomes. Some part of that is the effect of the Fair Works Commission decision to raise award and minimum wages by 3 and a bit percent. But talking to businesses such as yourselves suggests that there are pockets where wage pressures are becoming more acute. While those pockets are increasing gradually, they remain fairly contained at this point. The most recent inflation data, which I've got here, here's the history of inflation in our forecast, again, with the confidence intervals around it. They're also consistent with our forecasts. They show that inflation remains low but stable. Domestic price pressures remain subdued, though. Inflation is very close to 2%, 1.9% actually on a CPI basis, which is marginally below the bottom of our inflation target. As you can see there, we expect upward pressure on prices over the next couple of years, but again, this is expected to be quite a gradual process. So if you've been counting, you may have gathered by now that the key word in the discussion of the outlook is gradual, and I've had about 12 of them so far. Further progress on both inflation and unemployment is expected over the period ahead, as I just showed you, but it's expected to be only gradual. For some time, the board's view has been that holding the cash rate steady at 1.5% would assist that progress, with steady monetary policy promoting stability and confidence. If the economy continues to evolve as expected, higher interest rates are likely to be appropriate at some point, but notwithstanding this, the board currently doesn't see a strong case for a near-term adjustment in the cash rate. So having talked about the central forecast, I'll talk a bit about some of the uncertainties around this forecast. And one uncertainty relates to the global inflation outlook. We've experienced low inflation globally for a long period of time. There are now some signs of inflation starting to pick up. The global economy is close to full capacity, particularly in the advanced economies. And the US fiscal stimulus I mentioned earlier is still to have anywhere near its full effect in an economy that is very close to full capacity. So this, I think, is a similar situation to that in the late 60s and could lead to more inflation in the US than currently anticipated. In turn, that could lead to more tightening in monetary policy in the US than the market currently expects. They expect a bit more tightening, but not a lot more at this point. In such circumstances, you might also expect the neutral policy rate to rise, albeit gradually. Such a rise in growth and inflation offshore could lead to a depreciation of the currency here, given that the Australian economy appears to currently have more spare capacity than some other advanced economies. If this were to occur, we'd actually expect to get more output growth and a faster rise in inflation than we currently assume, but somewhat later than that happening elsewhere in the world. There's also a significant risk to the global economy from the current tensions around trade policy. While the effects of the measures announced thus far have been modest, there is clearly the potential for this to escalate. Australia has benefited from an open, inclusive and rules-based international system. We have as much at stake as any country in the continuation of this system. The statement has for some time highlighted the uncertainties around the outlook for China, so I'm afraid I'm not going to discuss them today because the governor's giving a talk entirely devoted to that issue next week, so I'm afraid you're going to have to wait for that to hear some discussion of that. But let me turn to some uncertainties around the domestic outlook. And one important uncertainty relates to household balance sheets. Australian households carry a fairly large amount of mortgage debt. That means they're more likely to be sensitive to changes in their incomes and also interest rates. And this poses risks to the outlook for the largest component of spending in the economy, which is consumption. One reason why I think debt remains high relative to income has been because income growth has been unexpectedly low for a number of many households. So if you go back a few decades, one of the easiest ways to pay down your mortgage was through inflation. So higher inflation back then was accompanied by higher wage growth. Because your mortgage is fixed in nominal terms, the debt level declined quite rapidly relative to households' income when incomes were growing quickly. But for the last number of years, household income growth has been quite subdued, which means that a number of households are probably carrying a larger mortgage for longer than they expected when they took out the loan. So while they can service the mortgage okay, it has consumed a larger share of their income for longer than they might have intended. So over recent years, a number of steps have been taken by regulators to try and strengthen resilience in household balance sheets. So it's worth remembering that lending standards have been tightened for a number of years now on the household side. From 2014, APRA and ASIC have strengthened their focus on lending practices. That's included ensuring that lenders' serviceability tests for new borrowers must use an interest rate of at least 7%. So the sort of mortgage rate you can get out there at the moment is 4% in most cases, if you get the right discount. So when they're assessing the ability for households to pay back their mortgage, they've got to use a rate of at least 7%. So that's more than 2% higher than it is currently. More recently, APRA has also been focused on ensuring lenders assess borrowers' incomes appropriately. Now, obviously, the Royal Commission has highlighted a number of cases where this has not been the case. An important consideration from a macro perspective is how widespread this has been, and also whether it's consequential for the ability of most households to afford to service their loans. So I take quite a bit of comfort from the fact that arrears rates on mortgages today remain very low. They're actually very close to their historic lows. So most households, nearly all households, are actually servicing their mortgages without too much drama. So even in WA, where there's been a marked rise in unemployment, it's gone up about 2 or 3 percentage points, house prices have fallen about around 10%, arrears rates have risen to around 1.5%, which is not all that high compared to what we've seen in other countries in similar circumstances, and also earlier episodes in Australia's history, including in the early 90s recession. We've also provided some information in the latest statement on interest rate resets on interest-only loans. So that can see the required mortgage payments rise by nearly 30 to 40% for some borrowers. So there are a number of those loans whose interest-only periods expire this year. It's also worth remembering that about the same number expired rolled over last year too. So we've actually already been in this process for a little while now. Our assessment is that there are quite a few mitigants which mean that nearly all of those borrowers are going to be able to cope with this increase in required payments. One of those is there's a large prevalence of offset accounts associated with those sort of mortgages. And also, many households have the ability to refinance to a principal and interest loan with a lower interest rate than they're actually paying on their interest-only loan. So while some borrowers will clearly struggle with this, our expectation is that most will be able to handle the adjustment so that the overall effect on the economy should be small. We're actually starting to see some effect here. So what we've got here is looking at the total mortgage payments by households, and you're splitting them up to interest, scheduled payments, and then also between scheduled principal repayments and unscheduled principal repayments. So unscheduled ones is when you're paying down your mortgage faster than you need to. See, that's come off a bit. Scheduled principal payments have gone up. A fair chunk of that, we think, is because of people switching off interest-only loans and actually paying down, now making scheduled principal repayments. That does imply that debt is going to amortise faster than it did over the last few years and probably has implications for credit growth. There is a risk of further tightening in lending standards in the period ahead. This may have its largest effect on the amount of funds an individual household can borrow rather than just how many people can actually take out a housing loan. Again, that means that credit growth going forward is probably going to be slower than it has been for some time. To me, that is more of an implication for house prices than it has for the outlook for the economy as a whole. Finally, in thinking about the resiliency of household balance sheets to higher interest rates, It's important to remember that about what the environment's going to be in which interest rates are rising. That's going to be one where wages and household incomes are growing faster than they do currently, which means that households should be able to afford higher mortgage payments. One final risk I'd just like to touch on briefly is the risk stemming from low wages growth. How much longer is wages growth going to remain at its current low rates? The experience of other countries with labour markets closer to full capacity than Australia's is that wage growth may remain lower than historical experience would suggest. So in Australia, if I show you here, this is from talking to firms that we do, as we do regularly, and we've done for quite a number of years, and talking about what sort of wage increases they're getting in their businesses. What you can see, and we've got the period from 2002 to 2014, and then over the last 3 or 4 years, you can see the distribution shifted to the left, and also it's really piled up around about 2%. So 2% very much seems to have become, or some number around 2.5 seems to be very much the focal point in terms of wage outcomes in the country at the moment. Whereas in the past, it was more around 3 to 4%. So there are signs of wage pressure emerging, but they do remain localised for now. And there is a risk that it may take a lower unemployment rate than we currently expect to generate a sustained move higher than the 2% focal point evident in many wage outcomes today. So there are some of the uncertainties the board discusses in its monthly monetary policy deliberations. They're not the central case, but they are some of the risks around it. Should those risks come to pass, then they're likely to have a material effect on the bank's outlook for the economy. In turn, it's quite possible that such revisions will be consequential for our assessment of the appropriate stance of monetary policy. But as I said, it's important to remember to think about the context in which these risks materialise. They're probably not going to materialise in isolation. Some of them may materialise at the same time, or the way they do actually materialise is different from the way I've just been talking about them. So let me finish by saying that monetary policy, just like business decisions that you make as CEOs, is very much about decision-making under uncertainty. And I've tried to highlight some of the uncertainties we think about in our deliberations today. The central forecast, though, that we have for the economy is for it to grow a little faster in 2018 and 2019, so this year and next, than it did last year. That should see the unemployment rate resume its gradual decline. It should also see wages growth and inflation gradually pick up from where they are currently. And in time, should that central forecast come to pass, high interest rates are likely to be appropriate. But the board, as I said earlier, does not see a strong case for a near-term adjustment in the cash rate and holds the view that by holding the cash rate steady, we can best assist the achievement of the desired economic outcomes. So let me finish there and very happy to take some questions. Thanks.
I think we've got some microphones around, so if anyone would like to ask some questions, please take the opportunity.
If you wouldn't mind saying who you are before you ask the question. Down over here.
Hi, my name is Teresa. I'm with the Australian Industry Group, and that was a very good presentation. I just wondered what your thoughts were on Industry 4.0 and employment and in financial services moving forward.
So I'm afraid I'm going to have to say I'm not 100% sure what Industry 4.0 is.
Well, I guess it's the whole digital disruption.
Oh, okay.
And
okay. So let me talk more generally about the effect of technology beyond just the financial sector. There is a fair bit going on in the financial sector. I think the interesting thing there in the financial side of things, on the disruption side of things, is just how much it's going to disrupt the large incumbents and how much it's going to be complementary to them versus disrupting to them. And I think that remains to be seen both here and elsewhere in the world. More generally, I think the interesting thing to think about technology is, so you can talk about disruption, and normally when people think about disruption, they think about that as resulting in job losses, and you can highlight the job losses, particularly in the financial services sector that have been announced recently. But if you go back over any number of years, we've always had these technological disruptions of varying forms, and jobs have been lost in particular sectors, but then other jobs have come along as a result of those disruptions. So I think one interesting thing to think about, which everyone always brings out, is if you go back the car replacing the horse and cart. And most people think, oh, well, so the blacksmiths were put out of business and then we got all those car factories. But there are a bunch of other stuff which comes along with cars. One of them is traffic lights. Another one is tar on the roads. So there are a whole bunch of other associated industries and employment which come along with it, which you don't necessarily think about rather than just the direct effect of the technological disruption. And I suppose we as the human race have been worried about technological disruption for around about the last 1,000 years or so, but we're still sitting here in an economy where a bit under 95% of the people who want a job have actually got one. So something has come along to provide that job, provide different openings for employment for people. One day, maybe that won't be the case, but to date, so far, as I said, for the last few hundred years, it has generally turned out to be the case. I think, as I said, in the financial services sector, I think the interesting thing there is how much, well, what impact that has, particularly on you as CFOs, in terms of opportunity that opens up for you. And one thing I am going to talk about is a bit of technology that we've just put out there, along with parts of the financial services industry, which I think does provide a lot of opportunities for you as CFOs. Hopefully, you're aware of the new payments platform, which went live in February this year. So that allows for real-time, fast settlement of payments 24/7 within a few seconds. What it also allows for, and I think this is particularly interesting for you to think of as CFOs, so in the past, when you sent a payment, you were very restricted in the information that you could send along there. It's actually the restriction on the size of the information that you could send with your payment dates back to the day of punch cards, if you can remember those. That constrained the length of the information you could send along with that payment. Today, on the new payments platform, you can pretty much send whatever you want alongside that payments mechanism. You can send a contract. You can send other information related to the purchase that has just taken place alongside that. I think that provides plenty of opportunity. So yes, that's a disruption in financial services, but I think it's a disruption which creates far more opportunities than it does cost. So I said the opportunities there for the businesses, I think, on the new payments platform are large, not just in the payment side of things, but actually in the information transfer that can go alongside that. Sorry, I can't see if anyone else.
Wally Borovac from Hydro Tasmania. So I just wanted to talk about macroeconomics. We get a lot of discussion about the Australian debt. However, we don't seem to get a lot of commentary at these sort of presentations on the US debt and where the bank sees that, dare I say, unravelling.
Just to give you some context, and Ms. O'Dwyer mentioned some of the numbers here. So we're looking at net debt, I think, of around somewhere in the ballpark of 20%, maybe a bit, peaking somewhere a little above that and coming down below that. US at the moment is government debt looks like it's going to be north of 100% of GDP by around about this time next year. Which puts if it doesn't do anything else for you, it puts the size of our debt in some context relative to a bunch of other countries around the world. I think that, as I said earlier, I think it's interesting, I suppose the best word to use, that the US in an economy which is close to full employment is running is injecting a fairly large amount of fiscal stimulus into the economy. It's not something you normally do. At this state of the cycle, when it's been done in the past, so it hasn't often ended up all that well. One thing which is always interesting about debt levels is that they're basically sustainable until they're not. And the reason why I say that is if you looked at Japan, which has a debt to GDP ratio well north of 200%, the US is only half that. Now, does that mean that the US is necessarily going to be sustainable? I don't know, but a number of people have been saying for a long time that that the Japanese debt position is not sustainable, but here we are today, more than two decades on from when people were first saying that it's not sustainable, and it's been sustained so far. bottom line of all of that is the one of the aspects that I think we have the least amount of insight on from in the economics profession is how much, how what level of debt is actually sustainable, particularly on the public debt side of things. And we're a bit better at it on the business side of things or the household side of things, but not on the public side of things. There are any number of different levels of debt which have been sustained, quite high levels which have been sustained for quite a long time. But then if I look at some of the Latin American countries in particular which have got in trouble in the past, they've got in trouble with a hell of a lot lower levels of debt than, say, the US has currently or is projected to have in the future. So I'm afraid that's not a particularly satisfactory answer to your question beyond basically saying that's one of the areas the economic profession is not particularly good at.
Okay, we might need to wrap up there. Guy, thank you so much for your time. Everybody, please thank Guy for his presentation. Thank you, Guy. That was so good. That was really good.